You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We're going to take you back to the winters of 1976 and 77, when four children were abducted and killed outside of the city of Detroit. J. Reuben Appleman was 6 years old at the time, and he was living in that city. He actually evaded an attempted kidnapping during that same time, which ended up fueling his lifelong passion with what would become known as the Oakland County child killings. Appleman currently lives in Boise. He received his MFA from Boise State University. He has also written a true crime story about this case called The Kill Jar. He joins me live in studio to talk more about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First, for a lot of people who may not be aware of this, this was the first time I had heard of this case. Tell me, give me an overview. Tell me about this case.
Well, in the mid-70s, 76 and 77, four kids in the Detroit area were abducted over a 13-month period. First, there was a little boy abducted, Mark Stebbins. A little while later, there was a little girl, Jill Robinson. A little while later, Christine Mihalik. And shortly after that, a little boy named Timothy King. All of these children were white, which is of note later in the story, but all of them had been held in captivity for a period of days, ranging from a few days to almost 2.5 weeks. They were sexually assaulted. It's believed it's known that at least two were. It's believed that others were. They were eventually all asphyxiated, which is, you know, just a cowardly way to murder somebody. But that's what happened to them. And they were dumped out onto the streets after that. They weren't difficult to find. You know, they were placed in plain sight, as it were. And at the time, the area around these killings was kind of swept up in hysteria a little bit. Nobody knew whose kid would be next. Nobody knew why this was happening. It was said that the killer would never be found. No trace evidence was left behind. No fingerprints, no blood, no indicator of why this had been done or who had been done by. And so it was kind of a scary time.
And you talk about in the book, which I think is interesting, is that when the autopsies were done on the children, that during this captivity, they were physically well taken care of.
Well, yes, they were physically well taken care of, and a lot of people want to latch on to that because it's kind of an anchor to something different than what we're used to thinking of when we think of murders. We think murders are always these quick, gruesome things, but mm-hmm. in reality, sure, they were fed and they were quote taken care of,
but they were still in a horrible situation. Let's not forget that.
They were in a horrible situation, but also if you want to keep somebody for, say, 19 days, as in the case of Christine Mihalik, you have to feed them.
Right.
So there's a lot was said about the fact that food was found in the stomachs of these children and such. But, you know, they were with their captors for several days and longer. So yes, they were fed. A lot was also said about the nature of their appearance after they were found. They were said to have been well scrubbed, so to speak. Their clothing had been cleaned and pressed. Their bodies had been washed. This was also an indicator to the public that they should believe the narrative that there was no evidence found. But in reality, after I dug into the case for quite a while, it was quite obvious that there was plenty of evidence found. So some of the things you're talking about are narratives pulled from the press, mm-hmm. But these narratives turned out to be like misdirects.
And I want to talk to you about that in a minute, but first I want to talk about the fact that you were 6 years old when this was going on.
Yeah.
You evaded an attempted abduction during that time. Looking back on it, do you think there was a connection to what they called the Oakland County child killer?
You know, this case anchored in me because, like you said, somebody tried to snatch me when I was walking home from a little drugstore at the time. I had stolen some candy, and there was a guy in the store who was posing as a security guard, and I saw him see me, and I put the candy back, and I left the store, and I walked several blocks away, and I tried to get home super quick, and sure enough, 3 or 4 blocks away, this guy pulled up in his car and tried to get me into his car. And I know now as an adult that that's not what security guards do when they're catching a little kid taking candy. They don't get into their car, follow him home, try to stuff him into their automobile. But at the time, I thought that's just how it goes down. And so nothing happened to me. I ran. I got away. I'd never told anybody because I was, committing a crime when I was noticed by this guy. So
you thought you had done something wrong, and here was this person that came up to try to make you confess and all of this. And you're 6 years old at the time, too.
Yeah, you bet. So I never told anybody. I never told my parents. It wasn't until I was raising kids of my own that this started to linger in my dreams and thoughts and such. You know, I kept remembering this event and kept thinking about the Oakland County child killer case. And I got online and realized that it had allegedly never been solved still. It had been over 3 decades at that time. Now it's over 4 decades. But that's the start of my interest in the case. As it turns out, no, I don't believe that the person who tried to abduct me was related to these crimes, although I did find what I believe was another child's statement to police about this person from the time, because at the time the cops were surveying schools and asking kids, you know, things like, had anybody ever tried to take you? What did he look like? What did he drive? All that stuff. And other children had reported this guy, I believe, and specifically one narrative describes him exactly as he is in my memory.
I'm speaking with Boise-based author J. Reuben Appleman. We are talking about his true crime book called The Kill Jar. It's about the Oakland County child killer. This was happening in the 1976 to 1977 in Detroit, Michigan. And let's talk a little bit about the fact that you took 10 years researching this. And take me now to the fact that you're right, this is so-called unsolved. There was a huge investigation going on, but then all of a sudden, these stopped. These abductions stopped. These murders stopped. The investigation was closed. It became a cold case. You spend 10 years on it. What do you find?
Well, you know, the official line at the time was that the task force that had been assigned to investigating these kids' murders was out of money. They ran out of resources. Prior to that, for the first few years of the investigation, there were 300 investigators working on this case. More money had been spent on the search for this alleged lone serial killer than on any hunt for any murderer in U.S. history at that time. 300 investigators, the Michigan State Police, the FBI, county police, city police, state police, we're all working allegedly together to try to solve these murders. And then suddenly the task force just shut down. It was very shocking to the area that had been used to previously, police on every corner, flyers on every corner, a very active hive of investigation. It's like if the Olympics came to your town and they left the next day,
right?
That's kind of what happened with no resolution. They claimed they had no more leads, although 20,000 leads had been filed. They claimed that they had no new leads that would amount to anything. So the case dried up, went cold. It was never closed. It remained an open investigation, but nobody was actively investigating.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into the documents, at first I thought like everybody else that I would never find anything either. I thought maybe this is true.
Well, you had this huge task force on it. All of this money, they didn't find anything. Why would you find anything?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And then immediately I knew otherwise. As soon as I referred to the documents just now, which is what I always call them. Basically, these are thousands of pages of documents from the Michigan State Police, the FBI, the county police from 2 different counties, city police from 5 or 6 cities around the murders. And these documents consist of autopsy reports and crime scene photos and internal departmental narratives from one police officer to another, witness testimony, statements from suspects, polygraph results, all, you know, anything you would ever want when
you
looking
found
at a case. Well, they were provided through Freedom of Information Act request.
Right.
But when I dipped into those, even just briefly, I realized that everything I had ever learned about the case was wrong. That there was no way this was a lone serial killer. That not only was there not no evidence, there were reams. There was reams of evidence. There was blood. There was semen. There was saliva. There were fingerprints. There were human hairs. There were pubic hairs, head hairs. There were dog hairs. There were.
So can't you take all of that DNA today and put it in a database? I mean, we have come so far in 40 years.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the DNA. What I soon discovered was, back to your original question, why did they shut down the case, so to speak? One of the main suspects was the son of a very politically entrenched figure in Detroit. Detroit was the epicenter of power and wealth at the time, just like the oil industry or the tech industry of today. There were many, many reasons why this case got shut down, and that's what I basically talk about throughout a vast majority of my book. It's not just that there's hard evidence. There's also failed polygraphs that were presented to the public as past polygraphs. There's also photographic evidence of the kind that implicates people. There's also there's everything. There's everything you want except for a living suspect to confess and a videotape. You know, you're missing those two things, but everything you want to close this case
is there.
From a successful prosecution standpoint, I mean, not to shut it down, but to successfully prosecute somebody is there. Based on today's prosecutorial standards, not just one person, but multiple people would have been convicted of these crimes.
Do you name anyone in the book?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There are several people are named. Unfortunately, it's not as simple as a couple of people who decided to go out, you know, Charlie Manson style or something and kill a few people. There was a vast, wide pornography syndicate operating in the northern part of the state in Michigan on an island that was owned by a wealthy heir to Detroit money. That pornography syndicate and the players in these murders are linked, I believe. I think there's a lot of evidence to prove that. There are task force members from the original investigation who have concurred with me. There are leading forensics people who have concurred with me on the evidence. There's all kinds of stuff that in the book points to this being much larger than just one person, and that it's unfortunate, but true that these murders were not necessarily only crimes of violence. They were crimes of, vice as well.
I thank you for coming in and talking today. You will be doing a release party at Rediscovered Books in Boise this evening, so people can come down, get a copy of your book, meet you. This is fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in and talking.
Thanks for
today.
Having me. Sorry it's so dark for the midday.
No. But, you know what? It's. I think it's an interesting topic, and I appreciate you coming in. Author J. Reuben Appelman, his book is called The Kill Jar. Let me get that right. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
Up next, we're going to be talking with a recent recipient of the Idaho Governor's Awards in the Arts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters.